Hello. Well, my new book, 12 Rules for Leaders, The Foundation for Intentional Leadership, with contributions from Bradley Madigan, is out now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and everywhere else you buy books. In this book, I address the 12 leadership areas that I have found leaders need to be the most intentional in to be the type of leader followers actually want to follow. From establishing a foundation of leading teams through managing conflict effectively, all the way through leading teams through change, knowing what to do and why to do it can help readers like you become better leaders in the real. 12 Rules for Leaders is a written continuation of the work I've been practically doing, leveraging the leadership training and development products and services of Leadership Toolbox all the way to Leading Keys. 12 Rules for Leaders represents a distillation of practical lessons I've learned, absorbed, and transmitted from training and developing 15,000 managers and supervisors over the last 10 years. Reading 12 Rules for Leaders and living it is like getting coaching from me directly without having to pay my full coaching rate. Look, this is a book written for all those leaders, some who call themselves managers and supervisors, who believe that their daily leadership decisions don't matter, or that their hard-won leadership positions are too innocuous and meaningless to matter much in the chaotic world of the now. 12 Rules for Leaders is the confirmation you are looking for, that you are the leader for exactly the historical moment happening right now. Head on over to leadershiptoolbox.us and scroll down the homepage. Click on the Buy Now button and purchase in hardcover, paperback, and Kindle format on Amazon, 12 Rules for Leaders, The Foundation for Intentional Leadership. And that's it for me. Out. Hello, my name is Hasan Sorrells, and this is the Leadership Lessons from the Great Books podcast, episode number 22, with our author today, Sun Tzu. From The Art of War. The weather means the seasons. The rules of the ancient military state that operations should not be carried out in winter or summer out of concern for the people. In ancient times, many soldiers lost their fingers to frostbite on the campaigns against the Huns, and many soldiers died of plague on campaigns against the southern tribes. This was because of carrying out operations in winter and summer. This is the meaning of the saying, don't go into another's territory at an unfavorable time. The terrain is to be assessed in terms of distance, difficulty, or ease of travel, dimensions, and safety. In any military operation, it is important first to know the lay of the land. When you know the distance to be traveled, then you can plan whether to proceed directly or by a circuitous route. When you know the difficulty or ease of travel, then you can determine the advantages of infantry or mounted troops. When you know the dimensions of the area, then you can assess how many troops you need, many or few. When you know the relative safety of the terrain, then you can discern whether to do battle or disperse. Leadership is a matter of intelligence, trustworthiness, humaneness, courage, and sternness. A general should have these five virtues. The way of the ancient kings was to consider humaneness foremost, while the martial artists consider intelligence foremost. This is because intelligence involves the ability to plan and to know when to change effectively. Trustworthiness means to make people sure of punishment or reward. Humaneness means love and compassion for people, being aware of their toils. Courage means to seize opportunities to make certain of victory without vacillation. Sternness means to establish discipline in the ranks by strict punishment. Reliance on intelligence alone results in rebelliousness. Exercise of humaneness alone results in weakness. Fixation on trust results in folly. Dependence on the strength of courage results in violence. Excessive sternness of command results in cruelty. When one has all five virtues together, each appropriate to its function, then one can be a military leader. Discipline means organization, chain of command, and logistics. Organization means that the troops must be grouped in a regulated manner. Chain of command means there must be officers to keep the troops together and lead them. Logistics means overseeing supplies. Every general has heard of these five things. Those who know them prevail. Those who do not know them do not prevail. Everyone has heard of these five things, but only those who deeply understand the principles of adaptation and impasse will win. Therefore, use these assessments for comparison to find out what the conditions are. That is to say, which political leadership has the way? Which general has ability? Who has the better climate and terrain? Whose discipline is effective? Whose troops are the stronger? Whose officers and soldiers are better trained? Whose system of reward and punishments is clearer? This is how you can know who will win. Leaders think clearly. Without clear thinking, a leader cannot write or even speak clearly. It follows then from that leaders write clearly. Without clear, compelling, and convincing writing, leaders cannot articulate a vision for the team, much less establish a coherent strategy. The intersection between clear thinking, clear writing, clear vision, and clear strategy lies in great literature, like the great literature we are going to read today. There are few books that are heads and tails above other books in the canon of thought in the world. I would rank The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli. Go check out the episode on that with our guest host, Erica Weed. On War by Karl von Clausewitz. We will be covering On War at some point in time within the next year and a half. And the third book in that triumvirate, The Art of War by Sun Tzu. Unlike A Book of Five Rings by Miyamoto Musashi, The Art of War is not a book of practical tactical aphorisms based on actual combat. Instead, Sun Tzu's book is a collection of phrases and observations that clearly and unambiguously encourage the reader to transform psychologically and emotionally before going out and acting materially. The book has been translated repeatedly and copied and rewritten since the unification of China and the book burning, engaged in by Emperor Shi Huangdi in the 2nd century BC. Yes, you heard that correctly. The 2nd century BC. The collection that is The Art of War has been around almost as long as the Iliad from Greece and is older even than the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. The warrior path of the book has been long, winding, and varied, but the best translations of The Art of War were done by the recently deceased Thomas Cleary, whose edition we are reading today, the Shambhala Dragon edition, one of the first ones put out. I believe that this edition came out let me check the interior of the book here. This edition came out in 1988, and I believe I picked it up off of the ground in a used bookstore where it was hiding somewhere around 1992 or so. According to the Wikipedia entry about Cleary, he earned a PhD in East Asian Languages and Civilizations from Harvard University and a JD from the Bowat Hall School of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. After completing his doctoral studies, Cleary had little involvement with the academic world. He said, and I quote, "There is too much oppression in a university setting. I want to stay independent and reach those who want to learn directly through my books." Back to the book, The Art of War. Like The Art of War, a product of the era of the Warring States, which ravaged China in the middle of the first millennium BCE, this great classic represents the prevailing attitude towards war that characterizes Sun Tzu's manual, that it is destructive even for the victors, often counterproductive, a reasonable course of action only when there is no other choice. To those who assist a leader by means of the Tao, do not use arms to coerce the world, for these things tend to reverse. Brambles grow where an army has been. Bad years follow a great war. Weapons are inauspicious instruments, not the tools of the enlightened. when there is no choice but to use them, it is best to be calm and free from greed and not celebrate victory. Those who celebrate victory are bloodthirsty, and the bloodthirsty cannot have their way with the world. In a similar way, the Art of War pinpoints anger and greed as fundamental causes of defeat. According to Sun Tzu, it is the unemotional, reserved, calm, detached warrior who wins, not the hothead seeking vengeance, and not the ambitious seeker of fortune. The Tao Te Ching says, those who are good at knighthood are not militaristic. Those who are good at battle do not become angry. Those who are good at prevailing over opponents do not get involved. The strategy of operating outside of the sphere of emotional influence is part of the general strategy of unfathomability that the Art of War emphasizes in characteristic Taoist style. Sun Tzu says, quote, those skilled in defense hide in the deepest depths of the earth. Those skilled in attack maneuver in the highest heights of the sky. Therefore, they can preserve themselves and achieve complete victory. This emphasis on the advantage of enigma pervades Taoist thinking, from the political realm to the realms of commerce and craft, where it is said, quote, a good merchant hides his treasures and appears to have nothing, unquote, and, a quote, a good craftsman leaves no traces, unquote. These sayings were adopted by Zen Buddhists to represent their art, and the uncanny approach to the warrior's way was taken up both literally and figuratively by Zen Buddhists, who were among the foremost students of Taoist classics and developers of esoteric martial arts. And we'll talk a little bit more about the path of Taoism or Taoism, depending upon what your pronunciation is. I prefer Tao, but you may prefer Tao. Either way, we're talking about the same thing. And we will talk more about this in just a bit. But I'm using this piece here of the translator's introduction from The Art of War to build a larger argument. So back to the book. Writings on both the civil and military aspects of political organization are found throughout the Taoist canon. The Book of the Huainan Masters, one of the greatest Taoist classics of the early Han Dynasty, which followed the dramatic end of the Warring States period, includes an entire chapter on Taoist military science that takes up the central theme of the practice of the Art of War. In martial arts, it is important that strategy be unfathomable, that form be concealed, and that movements be unexpected, so that preparedness against them be impossible. What enables a good general to win without fail is always having unfathomable wisdom and a modus operandi that leaves no tracks. Only the formless cannot be affected. Sages hide in unfathomability, so their feelings cannot be observed. They operate in formlessness, so their lines cannot be crossed. In The Art of War, Sun Tzu writes, be extremely subtle, even to the point of formlessness. Be extremely mysterious, even to the point of soundlessness. Thereby you can be the director of the opponent's fate. Both Sun Tzu and the Masters of Huainan, a group of Taoist and Confucian sages gathered by a local king, recognize a level of wisdom where conflict does not emerge and victory is not visible to the ordinary eye. But both books are, after all, written in recognition of the difficulty and rarity of this refined attainment. Like Sun Tzu's Art of War, the strategy of the Masters of Huainan provides for actual conflict not only as a last resort, but also as an operation to be carried out under the strictest conditions with appropriate leadership. A general must see alone and know alone, meaning that he must see what others do not see and know what others do not know. Seeing what others do not see is called brilliance. Knowing what others do not know is called genius. Brilliant geniuses win first, meaning that they defend in such a way as to be unassailable and attack in such a way as to be irresistible. The rigorous conditions of Taoist military action are paralleled by those of Taoist spiritual practice. Metaphors of peace and war are widely used in the manuals of Taoist meditation and exercise. One of the most basic principles of Taoist practice, derived from the teachings of the I Ching, is the mastery of emptiness and fullness, which has both physical and psychological implications. Given an entire chapter in The Art of War, the mastery of emptiness and fullness is fundamental to the physical accomplishment of Taoist fighting arts like absolute boxing, and to the organizational or sociopolitical aspects of the arts of both civil and military government. Explaining the understanding of emptiness and fullness as the way to certain victory, the Masters of Huainan say, this is a matter of emptiness and fullness. When there are rifts between superiors and subordinates, when generals and officers are disaffected with each other and dissatisfaction has built up in the minds of the troops, this is called emptiness. When the civilian leadership is intelligent and the military leadership is good, when superiors and subordinates are of like mind and will and energy operate together, this is called fullness. The skilled can fill their people with energy to confront the emptiness of others, while the incompetent drain their people of energy in the face of the fullness of others. When welfare and justice embrace the whole people, when public works are sufficient to meet national emergencies, when the policy of selection for office is satisfactory to the intelligent, when planning is sufficient to know strengths and weaknesses, that is the basis of certain victory. The political basis of military strength or the social basis of the strength of any organization is a teaching that is also rooted in the I Ching. In the Art of War, this is given premier importance as the first item in the first chapter on strategy involves examining the way of an adversary group, the moral fiber, the coherence of the social order, the popularity of the government, or the common morale. Under the right conditions, according to Sun Tzu, a small group could prevail over a larger group, and among the conditions that could make this possible were justice, order, cohesion, and morale. This is another pivot of Chinese thought that is also highlighted by the masters of Huainan in the context of military strategy. Final quote, strength is not just a matter of extensive territory and a large population. Victory is not just a matter of efficient armament. Security is not just a matter of high walls and deep moats. Authority is not just a matter of strict orders and frequent punishments. Those who establish a viable organization will survive, even if they are small, while those who establish a moribund organization will perish, even if they are large. I'm going to read a long passage here as you think about that, which will kind of give you a little bit of a background on Sun Tzu himself, the mythical Sun Tzu, such as it were, from the author Sima Xian, who gives the following biography of Sun Tzu. So settle in and listen to this. Sun Tzu was a native of the Xi state. His art of war brought him to the notice of Ho Lu, king of Wu. Ho Lu said to him, I have carefully perused your 13 chapters. May I submit your theory of managing soldiers to a slight test? Sun Tzu replied, you may. Ho Lu asked, may the test be applied to women? The answer was again in the affirmative, so arrangements were made to bring 180 ladies out of the palace. Sun Tzu divided them into two companies and placed one of the king's favorite concubines at the head of each. He then bade them all to take spears in their hands and addressed them thus. I presume you know the difference between front and back, right hand and left hand. The girls replied, yes. Sun Tzu went on, when I say eyes front, you must look straight ahead. When I say left turn, you must face towards your left hand. When I say right turn, you must face towards your right hand. When I say about turn, you must face right round towards your back. Again, the girls assented. The words of command having thus been explained, he set up the halberds and battle axes in order to begin the drill. Then, to the sound of drums, he gave the order right turn. But the girls only burst out laughing. Sun Tzu said, if words of command are not clear and distinct, if orders are not thoroughly understood, then the general is to blame. So he started drilling them again, and this time gave the order left turn, whereupon the girls once more burst into fits of laughter. Sun Tzu, if words of command are not clear and distinct, if orders are not thoroughly understood, the general is to blame. But if his orders are clear, and the soldiers nevertheless disobey, then it is the fault of their officers. So saying, he ordered the leaders of the two companies to be beheaded. Now, the king of Wu was watching the scene from the top of a raised pavilion, and when he saw that his favorite concubines were about to be executed, he was greatly alarmed and hurriedly set down the following message. We are not quite satisfied as to our general's ability to handle troops. If we are bereft of these two concubines, our meat and drink will lose their savor. It is our wish that they shall not be beheaded. Sun Tzu replied, having once received His Majesty's commission to be the general of his forces, there are certain commands of His Majesty which, acting in that capacity, I am unable to accept. Accordingly, he had the two leaders beheaded, and straightaway installed the pair next in order as leaders in their place. When this had been done, the drum was sounded for the drill once more, and the girls went through all the evolutions, turning to the right or to the left, marching ahead or wheeling back, kneeling or standing with perfect accuracy and precision, not venturing to utter a sound. Then Sun Tzu sent a messenger to the king saying, "Your soldiers, sire, are now properly drilled and disciplined and ready for your majesty's inspection. They can be put to any use that their sovereign may desire. Bid them go through fire and water, and they will not disobey." But the king replied, "Let our general cease drilling and return to camp. As for us, we have no wish to come down and inspect the troops." Thereupon Sun Tzu said, "The king is only fond of words and cannot translate them into deeds." After that, Hulu saw that Sun Tzu was the only one who knew how to handle an army and finally appointed him general. In the west, he defeated the Shu state and forced his way into Ying, the capital. To the north, he put fear into the states of Qi and Qin and spread his fame abroad amongst the feudal princes. And Sun Tzu shared in the might of the king. The art of war has been deeply influential in developing the strategic thought of readers in the military, in business, in management, and of course, leadership. Again, this collection of aphorisms and phrases that define a strategy has been around since the 2nd century BC, copied and rewritten, and handed down, and eventually through China, of course, and East Asia, and then eventually made its way overseas, first through Europe and then into America. If you decide to pick up your own copy of The Art of War, you will note that it is divided up into 13 chapters, or pion. The collection is referred to as being one zuhan, or one whole, one chronicle, right? The book is less a way to practically set up tactics. This is why people who like Machiavelli tend to dislike Sun Tzu. Because Sun Tzu does not talk about tactics in this book, whereas Machiavelli absolutely was a tactical thinker. So it's less a way to set up tactics and accomplish goals, and it is more a book that is steeped in, as we just read from the translator's introduction, the ideas and thoughts of Taoism, okay? Now, for those of you who are Western and Christian in thought, this will seem a little bit odd. Those of you who are secular and atheistic, you may be able to look into maybe Western forms of philosophy, like from the more mystical lens of philosophy, or psychology, even like Carl Jung, right? You may see some resonance here, right, in the ideas of Taoism. But Taoism really breaks down into being either a school of philosophical thought or religion, no one can really decide which one, that emphasizes living in harmony with the natural order of the universe, whose character one's intuition must discern to realize the potential for individual wisdom. Think about what I just said there. Unlike in Christianity, where wisdom is located in a book, Taoism asserts that wisdom and harmony are located in the natural order of the universe, and one's intuition must discern or realize the potential for wisdom, and what you discern, this is that individual idea, what you discern and what I discern are going to be two different forms of discernment. Not different forms of truth, but different forms of discernment, different forms of intuition, different forms of wisdom. By the way, wisdom is not truth. That's bait. Living in harmony with others, even as you are seeking to engage in conflict with them and even overthrow them, makes the ideas and strategies promulgated in the Art of War difficult to accept for the majority of people in the West. I know people who are so confused by this book that they never pick it up. It is almost impenetrable sometimes to some in the Western mind. Although, over the course of the last 30 years, as globalization has invariably begun to unwind, but as the backwater effects of globalization are still evident in our culture and in our time,
people are wrapping their arms around the art of war, and they're beginning to understand it. They're beginning to apply it to a lot of different places. So I see the art of war in art, or I'll see the art of war in business. And you can go pick up those books, but I would recommend reading the actual art of war itself first before you go jump off into these variants. The reason why the Western mind struggles with the art of war, and the reason why this podcast is going to be so short versus our usual marathon ones, is because Western thought tends to originate out of the penchant for philosophy in the West that's deeply compartmentalized, deeply contextualized to the immediate moment, and then, and here's the thing we do really well in the West, we adapt and forget and move forward to the future. Or maybe that's just America. That tendency that we have to adapt and forget, particularly that last piece of it, is what makes The Art of War a book for a truly elite thinker. This is why Norman Schwarzkopf mentioned it, the four-star general in the first Gulf War, as one of the books on his shelf. This is why thinkers in diplomatic circles have read this book. This is why elite thinkers, CEOs and up, have read this book in business management courses and have dissected it and have pulled it apart and have examined it. It is a book for the elite thinker who is on the leadership path, who understands deeply something, some piece of wisdom that is engaged in this book and contained in this book. And this is the piece of wisdom. So for all of you who don't think of yourselves as elite thinkers, right, in the development space or in the leadership space, I want to give you some hope, because this book's core message is this: harmony is everywhere, even in the midst of the most debilitating and detrimental conflicts. And if you can see both sides of the conflict, if you can see both sides of the thing that is occurring, and you can see how they harmoniously impact each other, you are the leader who, at the end of the day, will win. Back to The Art of War, the Thomas Cleary translated edition from the late 1980s. Planning a siege. Master Sun. Generals are the assistants of the nation. When their assistance is complete, the country is strong. When their assistance is defective, the country is weak. When generals are completely thorough, their plans do not leak out. If they are defective, their formations are revealed outside. The strength or weakness of a country depends on its generals. If the generals help the leadership and are thoroughly capable, then the country will be strong. If the generals do not help the leadership and harbor duplicity in their hearts, then the country will be weak. Therefore, it is imperative to be careful in choosing people for positions of responsibility. Complete means having both ability and intelligence. When a country has generals that are thoroughly able and intelligent, then that country is safe and strong. This means that generals have to be completely capable and completely knowledgeable in all operations. Generals in the field must be already acquainted with all the sciences of warfare before they can command their own soldiers and assess battle formations. Complete means that when generals are good and wise, then they are both loyal and capable. To be lacking means to be missing something. When the strategy of the generals is thoroughgoing, opponents cannot see into it, so the country is strong. If there is even a slight gap, then opponents can take aggressive advantage of this, so the country is weak. Master Sun. So there are three ways in which civil leadership causes military trouble. When a civil leadership, unaware of the facts, tells its armies to advance when it should not, or tells its armies to retreat when it should not, this is called tying up the armies. When the civil leadership is ignorant of military affairs but shares equally in the government of the armies, the soldiers get confused. When the civil leadership is ignorant of military maneuvers but shares equally in the command of the armies, the soldiers hesitate. Once the armies are confused and hesitant, trouble comes from competitors. This is called taking away victory by deranging the military. So there are five ways of knowing who will win. Once again, Master Sun, those who know when to fight and when not to fight are victorious. Those who discern when to use many or few troops are victorious. Those whose upper and lower ranks have the same desire are victorious. Those who face the unprepared with preparation are victorious. Those whose generals are able and are not constrained by their governments are victorious. These five are the ways to know who will win. Again, from Master Sun. So it is said that if you know others and know yourself, you will not be imperiled in 100 battles. If you do not know others but know yourself, you will win one and lose one. If you do not know others and do not know yourself, you will be imperiled in every single battle. Now, one of the interesting things about this translation, the Shambhala Dragon Edition of the Tao of the Art of War by Sun Tzu, translated by the late great Thomas Cleary. Okay, one of the interesting things about this translation is that there is included inside of this translation a ton of extra information. The translator's introduction is quite thorough. It's almost 40 pages in and of itself. But then also he has included a commentary on Master Sun's information, which I was reading initially there in that first part, the first chunk, and then I just went directly to Master Sun, and every time I said his name, those are words directly from him. But he selected certain commentaries that supported the things that were stated in the Art of War. So you get a little extra, initially stated in the Art of War. That way you get a little extra support. And these are, I'll just read you what he actually said. He says, the commentaries in this translation are selected from a standard collection of 11 interpretives. So Cao Cao, which is one of the most distinguished military figures of Chinese history, known for his keen intellect and his cunning, Cao received an honorary degree for social virtues and began his official career at the age of 20. He held a number of important military posts and particularly distinguished himself in a campaign against rebels when he was about 30 years old. Then you have Meng Shi from the Liang Dynasty, 502 to 556. By the way, Cao Cao came from Cao Cao's dynasty, 155 to 200 CE. So on to Meng Shi. Meng Shi, or Mr. Meng, is apparently known only for his commentary on the Art of War. His time was marked by civil war and massive suffering. Then you have the next commentator, Jia Lin of the Tang Dynasty, 618 to 906. Jia Lin seems to be known only for his commentary on the Art of War. During the Tang Dynasty, China enlarged its empire, extended its cultural and political influence over other peoples, some of whom eventually used their experience under Chinese rule to take over large parts of China themselves. Tang Dynasty China also helped establish national governments in Japan, Tibet, and Yunnan. Okay. Then you have Li Quan, who came out of the Tang Dynasty as well, 618 to 906. Li Quan was a devotee of Taoism as well as the martial arts. He lived on the Mountain of Few Abodes, where Bodhidharma, the semi-legendary founder of Chan Buddhism, lived during his last years in China. Taoist tradition attributes Shaolin boxing, a popular school of martial arts, in the same Bodhidharma. Li Quan was a student of the Yin Convergence classic, Yin Fu Jing, a Taoist text attributed to antiquity and traditionally interpreted in both martial and cultural terms. He is said to have read this laconic text thousands of times without understanding its meaning. This is Li Quan, one of the commentators on Master Sun's comments in The Art of War. Later, he went to Black Horse Mountain, the famous site of the tomb of the first emperor of China, where he met an old woman who gave him a charm and explained the meaning of the classic to him. This woman is identified with the old woman of Black Horse Mountain of folklore, who is said to have been a ruler of ancient times, considered a Taoist immortal by the people of the Tang Dynasty. Whatever the true identity of his mentor may have been, Li Quan is known for his military strategy and wrote a commentary on the Yin Convergence classic from that point of view. Eventually, he went to the mountains to study Taoism. Then you have some other commentators. Du Yu, 735 to 812. Du Ma, 803 to 852. Zhang Yu, from the Sung Dynasty, 960 to 1278. And Mei Yoshen, 102 to 1060. 1002 to 1060. And finally, Wang Ji of the Sung Dynasty, early 11th century. I said finally, I was wrong. There's one more commentator in this, the translator's edition, the Thomas Cleary translated edition of The Art of War. There's one last commentator in here, Chen Hao of the Sung Dynasty, the early 12th century, and Ho Yangji. So all of these writers, Cleary looked at, and he examined their translations, and not only their translations of The Art of War, but also their commentaries on The Art of War from the perspective of Taoism, Zen Buddhism, the battles that were going on of the various dynasties in China, and Cleary managed to collapse all of these meanings together and used those meanings and those commentaries to fill out the empty spaces, right, for Westerners. As I was just saying in the previous section, Westerners struggle with the Art of War in its purest form. And so what the commentaries do and what Cleary has done in this, the Shambhala Dragon edition of the Art of War, is he's taken all of these various commentators, 12 of them in all, and he has placed them underneath Master Sun's own comments and has broadened the scope of the book so that you can understand the things that are being said, like the things that are being said about civil leadership. Civil leadership is really interesting, right? I mean, in reading just those sections from The Art of War, I mean, when Master Sun talks about, the nature of civil leadership, let's see, that was page 79 in the Cleary translation. I love this. I'm going to go back to Master Sun for just a second. So there are three ways in which a civil leadership causes the military trouble. When a civil leadership unaware of the facts tells its armies to advance when it should not, or tells its armies to retreat when it should not, this is called tying up the armies. When the civil leadership is ignorant of military affairs but shares equally in the government of the armies, the soldiers get confused. When the civil leadership is ignorant of military maneuvers but shares equally in the command of the armies, the soldiers hesitate. Once the armies are confused and hesitant, trouble comes from competitors. This is called taking away victory by deranging the military. Ignorance of the facts of the circumstances, the particular details, and the nature of the environment by leadership, civil or otherwise, removed from the facts on the ground itself, is a recipe for disaster. There are myriad examples of this disconnect in military history. I mean, the first thing I thought of was of the debacle known as the Vietnam War, but you can even apply that to Afghanistan or the early days of the Second Iraq War in the American context. You can apply it to current events going on in the Ukraine, right, with Russia. You can apply this to military juntas that go on in countries on the African continent and on the South American continent. And of course, you can apply it to militaristic adventuring that has occurred all throughout East Asia, from Japan to Korea to China and even India. It's interesting, however, that these disconnects were happening even in Sun Tzu's time. We have this mythical belief that somehow either we're more fools than they were in the past, or that we're brighter than they were in the past, when the reality is we're probably just exactly the same. The only difference is we get our information a little bit faster. And of course, in business history, there are myriad examples of this disconnect. The disconnect between the leadership and the middle managers who are actually on the ground. And of course, the disconnect between the frontline soldiers or the frontline employees and those all the way in the C-suite. What can leaders learn from Sun Tzu in order to navigate this disconnect? What can they learn from the commentaries on this disconnect that are in this edition of The Art of War? Well, they learn a couple of different things, but the biggest one is that leaders in titles and positions must be able to humbly admit when they don't know what's going on. They can't know everything. No one can know everything. Leaders who fail get tripped up on their own egos. They make decisions that are too late, too early, or as Sun Tzu would say, too incompetent, and then they muck up the works. Leaders follow when appropriate, but they are clear when they are doing so, and not for their own benefit, but for the benefit of the followers that they are seeking to lead. And back to the book, Sun Tzu and the Art of War. Master Sun, appear where they cannot go, head for where they least expect you, to travel hundreds of miles without fatigue, go over land where there are no people. To unfailingly take what you attack, attack where there is no defense. For unfailingly securing defense, defend where there is no attack. Once again, Master Sun. So in the case of those who are skilled in attack, their opponents do not know where to defend. In the case of those skilled in defense, their opponents do not know where to attack. Master Sun, yet again, be extremely subtle, even to the point of formlessness. Be extremely mysterious, even to the point of soundlessness. Thereby you can be the director of the opponent's fate. Going to read a couple of the commentators on this. Du Mu, the subtle is stillness, the mysterious is movement. Stillness is defense, movement is attack. Whether opponents live or die depends on you. So you are as though the director of their fate. Do you yet again. This means being so subtle as to be imperceptible and to be able to change suddenly like a mysterious spirit. And Mei, Yao Shen, formlessness means being so subtle and secret that no one can spy on you. Soundlessness means being so mysteriously swift that no one notices you. For Master Sun, to advance irresistibly, push through their gaps. To retreat elusively, outspeed them. For Master Sun, yet again, therefore, when you want to do battle, even if the opponent is deeply entrenched in a defensive position, he will be unable to avoid fighting if you attack, where he will surely go to the rescue. From commentary from Cao Cao and Li Quan, both made the same points. Cut off their supply routes, guard their return routes, and attack their civilian leadership. Du Mu, if you are on your home territory and the opponents are invaders, then cut off their supplies and guard their return routes. By the way, we're seeing this happen live right now in the world. If you are on the opponent's home ground, then attack the civilian leadership. For Master Sun, when you do not want to do battle, even if you draw a line on the ground to hold, the opponent cannot fight with you because you set him off on the wrong track. I kind of like that one. Going forward a little bit, talking about armed struggle, Master Sun, the ordinary rule for use of military force is for the military command to receive the orders from the civilian authorities, then to gather and mass the troops, quartering them together. Nothing is harder than armed struggle. From Master Sun, the difficulty of armed struggle is to make long distances near and make problems into advantages. Master Sun, yet again, therefore you make their route a long one, luring them on in hopes of gain. When you set out after others and arrive before them, you know the strategy of making the distant near. From Master Sun, yet again, therefore armed struggle is considered profitable and armed struggle is considered dangerous. From Master Sun, to mobilize the whole army to struggle for advantage would take too long, yet to struggle for the advantage with a stripped down army results in a lack of equipment. So if you travel light, not stopping day or night, doubling your usual pace, struggling for an advantage 100 miles away, your military leaders will be captured. Strong soldiers will get there first, the weary later on, as a rule. 1 in 10 make it. Finally, from Master Sun, from The Art of War, the chapter on armed struggle. Struggling for an advantage 50 miles away will thwart the forward leadership, and as a rule, only 50% of the soldiers make it. Struggle for an advantage 30 miles away, and 2 out of 3 get there. So an army perishes if it has no equipment, it perishes if it has no food, and it perishes if it has no money. From the Tao of Jeet Kune Do, a book written in the 1960s by a guy you may have heard of, Bruce Lee, which we will cover on an upcoming episode of this podcast. I want to quote directly as it relates to the Art of War in that section we just read. And I quote directly from Bruce Lee. Instead of facing combat in its suchness, then most systems of martial art accumulate a fancy mess that distorts and cramps their practitioners and distracts them from the actual reality of combat, which is simple and direct. Instead of going to the heart of things, flowery forms, otherwise known as organized despair, and artificial techniques are ritualistically practiced to simulate actual combat. Thus, instead of being in combat, these practitioners are doing something about combat. Worse still, supermental power and spiritual this and spiritual that are desperately incorporated until these practitioners drift further and further into mystery and abstraction. All such things are futile attempts to arrest and fix the ever-changing movements in combat and to dissect them like a corpse. I believe Sun Tzu would agree with that. Leaders know that armed struggle, formlessness, and void. Leaders know that all these things ultimately at the end of the day have to be practical, and leaders stay practical. They avoid drifting into abstraction, and they remain grounded in the actual being of being, not only in combat, but of being in leadership. So, what are we to draw from Sun Tzu's The Art of War? By the way, short podcast episode today. The actual core content's a little under an hour. Kind of goes along with the book. So, there you go. You're going to have to read it. You're going to have to pick it up. You're going to have to figure out how it applies to you. You are going to have to read the aphorisms. Now, my best suggestion for you as a leader would be to combine it with something that you respect. Maybe Machiavelli, maybe von Clausewitz, maybe your favorite commentator, whoever it is, combine the ideas and the thoughts about philosophy and strategy in The Art of War to change your thinking wherever you may happen to be leading. At the end, we always ask, how can leaders get out there and stay on the path? How do you stay on the path of the book that's well over 2,000 years old? Well, here's how you stay on the path. I think the first big thing that is definitely clear from Sun Tzu's writing is that leaders think and write clearly. If you're not thinking clearly, then you cannot write clearly. And if you cannot write clearly, you cannot craft a compelling vision for the team. If you cannot craft a compelling vision, you cannot be candid when that vision goes off the rails. And you will lack the courage to face the challenge of the entire project going off the rails. Leaders think and write clearly first. That's why the book is so short. Fundamentally, you rip out all the commentaries, and Sun Tzu's Art of War is literally only a few pages long. You could put it on one scroll. You could put it on a roll of toilet paper. And I think there are a few folks who have. I believe there's a Jim Jarmusch movie where that actually occurred. But anyway, it's short. Because you don't need much if you're thinking clearly, if you're distilling the lessons down to their purest form. That leads into the second point. Leaders change their thinking in order to execute strategy before tactics. Strategy matters more than tactics. And yes, I know, I'm philosophically bent in this direction anyway, as those of you who have been listening to me for a while know, but it has less to do with my philosophical bent and more to do with the actual practice of the world. Your thinking about leadership, your thinking about being a leader matters almost infinitely more than you just doing leadership. You know who does leadership? People in leadership positions who confuse authority and power with leadership. That's who does leadership. But if you actually want to be a leader, you must change your thinking and execute on strategy before you worry about which lever to pull in which human being. When you're thinking about all of this, you have to think about how much this is going to take out of you. And you know what leaders do? Leaders count the cost before they execute a strategy. They not only count the cost of the strategy itself, they count the cost of the strategy to the team, they count the cost of the strategy to the culture, they count the cost of the strategy, they delineate the cost of the strategy to the organization before they act. Not in the process of acting, not when they get new information, but before they act, they count the cost. And then as the costs increase, they have the option to change their mind, to double down, or to retreat. But they count the costs first, and they're hyper clear about what those costs are in their minds, and then they are able to articulate them clearly in writing and speaking to their team. Finally, the fourth point, and this is the biggest one. Leaders stay practical. They avoid drifting into abstraction, and they remain grounded in the actual act of being a leader, the actual act of leading. That's where they remain practical. We need more practicality. And I think Sun Tzu would agree with that. Even after over 2,000 years, I think Sun Tzu would desperately agree with that. It's not a new technology. It's not a new tactic that's going to get you where it is you want to go, because the thing that you're fundamentally dealing with as a leader is something that is as old, well, as humanity. Leaders are leading the human heart. And that ain't going to change, no matter what we slap on top of it. At least not in our lifetimes. And well, that's it for me.
Listen and subscribe to the Leadership Lessons from the Great Books podcast on all the major podcast players that you listen to, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and of course, Spotify. And leave a 5-star review if you like the Leadership Lessons from the Great Books podcast. Look, we need those reviews to grow, and it's the easiest way that you can help us actually grow this show. And of course, tell all your friends. If you want to get started down the leadership path, our products from HSCT Publishing can help you and your team do that. So check out our training webinars, our coaching services, and more at leadershiptoolbox.us, and check out our video-based subscription service at leadingkeys.com. We've got books that will help you and your team grow. So pick up a copy today of My Boss Doesn't Care, 100 Essays on Disrupting Your Workplace by Disrupting Your Boss, and subscribe to the Little Red podcast we launched earlier this year with the same name as this Little Red book, My Boss Doesn't Care, 100 Essays on Disrupting Your Workplace by Disrupting Your Boss. And of course, pick up my most recent book, 12 Rules for Leaders, The Foundation of Intentional Leadership, written with Bradley Madigan. You're going to want to pick up a copy of that in April 2022. And you can get both of these books in paperback, hardcover, or as ebooks on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, and any other place you order books on demand. Finally, we are on YouTube, or I'm on YouTube, or someone around here is on YouTube. So like and subscribe to the video version of the Leadership Lessons from the Great Books podcast on the HSCT Publishing channel on YouTube. Just search for HSCT Publishing on YouTube and hit the subscribe button to get updates every single time we upload a new video, which we do that at least once a week. And subscribe to the Hasan Sorrells Presents Audio Experience podcast Yes, I have 3 podcasts on YouTube where I talk more casually with a wider range of people about all matters that matter in the world today. Everything from fatherhood to criminal justice, Christianity to artificial intelligence. We cover the entire plethora of things that are floating around in my mind, and that's why it's called an audio experience. All right, well, that's it for me. Out.